I believe that if you read any holy book, which is followed by the followers of any religion, you come to this conclusion that at least there are some wisdom in that book. Be it the book of Muslims, the book of Jewish people, Christians, even let's talk about Zoroastrians and Hindus. I mean, no holy book is free from any kind of wisdom. In each holy book, we have at least some verses which are in line with human values. Let's forget about, that religion's value. Okay, so that is why, as you rightly mentioned, if you read the book, you find some wisdoms, and it prevents you from burning the whole book and setting that into fire. As I mentioned, it is coming from, a kind of anger and hatred toward the religion of Islam.
Yes.
But the point is that what happened in reality, the reaction of the people is that after each and every such event, more people try to read the Book of Quran. It has happened before, after 9/11, for example, the number of copies of Quran sold in the Western countries increased a lot. And after similar events of hatred and desecration regarding the Noble Book of Quran, we see that more people are inclined to read the Quran. And this is the plan of God. I mean, they plan, as the Quran says, وَمَكَرُوا وَمَكَرَ اللَّهُ وَاللَّهُ خَيْرُ الْمَاكَرِينَ. They want to desecrate the Quran, but the conclusion is that more people, they become curious to know about the Noble Book of Quran, they study and read the verses of the Quran, and more people accept this book as their holy book.
Okay. Thank you very much. We can say some of the statements of the Muslim lands have suggested to put sanction or ban of some of the goods and selling and buying goods from especially Denmark and Sweden. The others believed that the majalis must be held for the public and collective recitation of the Holy Quran, and also inviting the non-Muslims to have debate and discussions regarding the text of the Holy Quran, and first read the text of the Holy Quran, and then decide whatever you like.
Yeah, I mean, the great, great majority of the people do not like the desecration of the holy book. But the point is that this action is done by the support of a government.
Yes.
And that is why we should not take it lightly.
Yes.
And it is in need of the reaction of the Muslims and Muslim governments.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. The another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban li aliyin wa husayin wa hasan. Li aliyin wa husayin wa hasan. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن.
Sierra Leone, I've come to Sierra Leone to investigate a robbery, a theft of such mammoth proportions. I'm shocked to find the place not swarming with Interpol. The country has some of the largest iron ore deposits in the world. It's being mined by two British companies who are getting away with hardly paying any tax to the government. This is the story of how a potentially wealthy country remains one of the poorest in the world. Ten years ago, Sierra Leone was gripped by a brutal civil war. Child soldiers and gruesome images of mass amputations made the country famous. Over 50,000 people were killed or maimed. The war was largely fought over control of diamonds, or blood diamonds as they became known. Now, however, a new treasure has been found: iron ore. Step forward, two British companies, London Mining and African Minerals. Their arrival was celebrated in the country. They would bring in much-needed foreign investment, jobs, infrastructure, and revenue. However, as the first shipments of iron ore are on their way out of the country, there's more rioting than celebrating.
In 2009, a law was passed, the Mines and Minerals Act. Now, it was largely signed to stop the kind of corruption which played such a major role in starting the civil war. Now, the law stipulates that mining companies operating in Sierra Leone must pay at least 37.5% tax.
When the communists come, they negotiate their own tax regime. For example, London Mining negotiated their own tax regime to as low as 3%.
When it should have been 37.5%.
Exactly. They negotiated theirs to as low as 3%, and African Minerals take the cue from them by negotiating theirs to 6%.
There is also a clause that allows the company to bypass national laws.
If there's a conflict between the Mining Act and the agreement, then the agreement stands. Right, the agreement stands.
So that means this company is effectively above the law?
Of course, that means the company is above the law. That's exactly the situation. That's the situation exactly.
At the National Campaign for Justice and Development in Freetown, Aminata shows me the case details. She tells me that through tax holidays and low tax rates, the companies are getting off with hardly paying any money to the government. She also tells me that in terms of tax receipts, the UK would be making more money from the mining than would Sierra Leone.
How does that make you feel?
It makes me feel bad. In fact, in the first place, when I saw this, or when my organization saw this, we felt seriously bad. And when we made our first press release, we called on Britain to not just turn an eye, blind eye to these processes. They are supporting us. We go begging to them for aid. We go begging to them for loans. We go begging to them for so many things. Let them come and see what is happening. They are getting more from our natural resource wealth on the ground. They can support us to have more and then save them from the embarrassments of us going begging for more aid to come and support our social sectors.
The companies on their websites declare the great things they are bringing to the country. As well as to provide jobs for thousands of local people, they have promised to build schools, health centres, roads, and to hand out scholarships. The owner of African Minerals, Frank Timmis, has stated, "My goal is to contribute to the economic growth of these regions so that their children can have the same lifestyle as my own children." Before we headed out to these new oases of development, we had a meeting with a former security guard at African Minerals who wanted to blow the whistle on what was really happening.
During the exploration, African Minerals sent some guys from expats from all over the world, like UK, Australia, Ghana, and other African countries. They came here to come and do the exploration. And during the exploration, they found out that the village contained iron ore. And I can tell you this for free. When I was in Ferengbeya, like during the morning, when it's raining season, people can just sweep their verandas and outside like that. They go and wash it in the river. They see gold. So Africa Minerals came to realize that the place is so lucrative. So as a result, they deemed it necessary that they're going to buy all the place from the local people, and which they did. But most of the money that was given to the local people was not even enough for their lands or for their houses.
Are African Minerals fulfilling any of their promises around that area?
Well, they talk about school, but I've not seen the school yet. They said they're going to build a mining school for little kids. You know, they're going to open a bank so that people will not have constraints to come to McKinney and collect their money. But I've not seen nothing like that. Everybody is grumbling.
One of the first things you notice about Sierra Leone is that even by developing world standards, the roads here are terrible. We're now heading about 2 hours east of the capital to Lunsar town, where London Mining have an agreement to mine iron ore. They've just sent out their first shipment.
Outside their offices, crowds of people gathered every day.
We are looking for a job as a London mining. That's why I'm sitting here. So we are here for a long time, about 2 months
now. As for me now, I can boast of 20.
You've been here for 2 months?
Yes, it's more than 2 months now we're here.
Staying in Lunsar, waiting outside the offices?
Lunsar, I'll stay in Lunsar. I'm born of Lunsar.
And is that the same as most people? You've been here a long time. How long have people here been here?
Over 2 years now. Still looking for job, driving job. As for me,
the company promised that the majority of jobs would go to Sierra Leoneans. However, these people complain that very few jobs are going to local people.
Some of us capable to do the job. All of us, most of 70% are capable to do the job. But the problem, they came from out, from different countries, neighboring countries, when they use money to bribe, and then they give them the job. The only thing we can say to the government is just to provide more jobs to the country and strict on to employ the...
They should give us the priority.
To employ the
priority should come first for the citizen of Sierra Leone, not for foreigners.
Yes.
I was surprised to hear most of these job seekers used to work for African Minerals, but quit.
So what were the conditions like in African Minerals?
Well, the condition is very poor. Same as others, very poor. When they came and talk nicely, let people work for them. After then, they changed.
They complained of not being given drinking water and of bad accommodation.
The money is too little, the expatriates are paying us, then the cost of living in the country is so much. So we are just working for nothing. You will get old without no good nothing at the bank.
They are exploiting us, and we are suffering. Those big guys in Freetown, the ministers, president, they are enjoying, but we are suffering.
The mining companies, especially London Mining, are ubiquitous in Sierra Leone. Massive companies in such a small country, employing thousands of local people. Now, we've repeatedly asked London Mining for access to their mines for us to be allowed to film inside. They've repeatedly tried to delay the possibility of us doing that, though. So we've come ourselves, we've hired some bikes, and we're trying to get as close as we can. We've sent some local people ahead to see if the coast is clear.
This is where it all starts. There's no denying that civilization as we know it wouldn't get far without scenes like these. The car that you drive, the skyscrapers that dominate our skylines, even this rather aggressive-looking fence, all wouldn't exist without iron ore. Back at the office, the daily intake of workers was taking place. Youth unemployment in Sierra Leone is amongst the highest in the world. After a decade of war, it stands at nearly 50%. Just a few hours ago, these people were complaining to me of how they were being exploited.
This morning, some men are lucky enough to be called forward for a medical. Some of those men might be lucky enough in turn to actually get a job. But as you can see, there are going to be many more people who day after day are coming here and going away empty-handed.
Nearby, I had a meeting with a local chief. He was one of the signatories of an agreement between London Mining and the local community.
Mr. Kroma, are you happy that London Mining is in your chiefdom?
Of course, because it is a very big opportunity. Now that we've got another big investor like London Mining, I'm very happy of their coming, and I'm satisfied with the way they've started things.
In the agreement, London Mining promised to give agricultural equipment, a water supply and electricity to the local community. However, the chief tells me that so far none of these promises have been lived up to.
You're confident that all these promises are, in the end, going to...
I believe they will keep up to that agreement for sure.
The chief did say that the only promise so far that had been lived up to was the roads. The company promised to pave 3 roads per year. After 6 years in Linsar town, 5 roads, he says, have been paved.
And all these 5 roads that I've just said, they are working on them, surface dressing, culvert, and making a lay-by and a parking places for vehicles and pedestrians.
We set off to take a look.
We've been searching all around Linsar town for these paved roads. However, quite frankly, we haven't been able to find any. Now, we're on Shaka Stephen Street right now, which is one of the roads that the chieftain coordinator told us was paved. However, as you can see, it's still just a dirt track. Now, there is some work going on down here, though. I wonder if that's got anything to do with London Mining.
Government. They make this road. They are not London Mining. They make this road. Now, government.
There's an agreement between London Mining and the local chiefs that 3 roads in Linsar will be paved every year.
They are telling tales about that.
Telling tales?
Yes.
So they haven't done any work?
No work.
He told you people that this road has already been...
While we were filming, some local people accosted us, telling us to leave. They thought we were making a propaganda film for London Mining.
Listen, we work with these sorts of people and they tell you that it is not true and this road is not being paved.
London Mining, they rely on propaganda. They are very good on that.
After convincing him that we were instead independent journalists, he calmed down a little.
We've seen an agreement between the local chiefs and London Mining which promises to pave 3 roads a year in Linsar town. Do you know about this agreement?
No, not at all.
You don't know about this agreement?
I don't know. Not at all. Only at one time I heard them in the radio saying that we've turned Linsar Koloko Road to this roundabout. And they've turned also this roundabout that this Shaka Stephen Street you are standing.
But it's not been
paved. Well, look at the scenario. This is the scenario.
So why is that happening? London Mining is saying they're doing these things, but they're not being done.
Not at all. They're very eloquent in propaganda.
What do you think of your chiefs?
The chief is also. In fact, he was the one that went to the radio and announced publicly that London Mining, they've tarred Koloko Road and also Shaka Stephen Street, which of course is a very blank lie, my brother.
Well, the chief coordinator lives about 200 metres down that road. He told us that these roads have been paved. He must know that they're not. Why is he lying?
Yeah, very correct. Is this a paved road? Is this a paved road?
Why is your chief lying?
Well, I don't know. Maybe he's getting something from London Mining.
You seem very angry about this. Are you going to do anything about it?
No.
What?
We just have to... That's why...
We'll wait.
We are waiting for time.
We'll wait.
For what? Till they don't pave any more roads?
Well, that wasn't quite the response I was expecting. Still, I found myself wondering what can local people really do about it. Recently, protests against African minerals turned violent. Millions of dollars of mining equipment was destroyed.
Yesterday, the National Movement for Justice and Development released a damning report criticising the government's agreements with the mining companies. Now, we've just heard of a press conference being held on the other side of town by another civil society group who, in turn, have condemned the report and are defending the mining companies.
Equipment cost over $2 million was damaged, quite recently, because of negative propagation. And we don't want to see whereby the atmosphere, with regard to our investment policy, will be pervaded with all sorts of propaganda, scaring away investors.
Amongst the many hastily written placards, journalists were abundant, ready to spread the message of the conference in the morning's papers. One of the speakers even claimed that the National Movement for Justice and Development might have links with the Mujahideen and Al-Qaeda.
Do you think he's been paid?
Well, I don't know. I don't have evidence, but there is every likelihood that he should be paid. Why is he speaking on behalf of a single company? There are other companies who've been making series of press statements and he's not been reacting to them. Why now? That's why I asked the question in the press conference. Why are you advocating for African minerals if you are not being paid?
Are you working for African Minerals?
No, I'm not working for African Minerals, but I've got a colleague.
Have they paid you to come here today?
No, never. But according to their own policies that they bring in the country, really I appreciated it so much. And then it has even decreased the level of robbery.
And one of the speakers just said there that he thinks there may be links between NMJD and the Mujahideen and Al-Qaeda. Do you think there's any truth to that?
Well, I disagree with that particular statement, right? It was just a propaganda, just to make things sweeter.
Ever since we got to Sierra Leone, we had been trying to secure an interview with one of the big men in government. Finally, the Minister of Mines had agreed to see us. However, when we got there, he wouldn't talk. The international news channel Al Jazeera had just done a secret camera sting on the Vice President about corruption. Everyone in government was terrified of journalists. Walking through the corridors, though, I noticed the strangest thing. There were white people everywhere, all belonging to various foreign organizations. Just down the hall from the Ministry of Mines is the Adam Smith Institute, which is run by the World Bank. In the office of the Chief of Staff, there's Tony Blair's African Governance Initiative.
So their offices are actually inside the government ministries?
They are inside the offices, just next door to the boss.
Would you go as far as saying that these organizations are running Sierra Leone?
They are kind of running a shadow government. They are running a shadow government because if they are everywhere, and no decision is taken without their input, right, and they have the right to bring in new ideas, right? And most times when they bring in new ideas, the government sees it as, oh, this is a hot cake, so they just take it.
None of these organizations would speak to us. However, with so many international organizations advising the government, surely they would be able to make sure that the country got a good deal from the mining companies.
These guys are pro-corporate, to say the least. They are pro-corporate. So, and they have strong ties with international financial institutions, right? So when they come, of course, they emphasize on creating of liberalizing the market, right? Liberalizing the market by way of granting tax exemptions and by way of opening the market to foreign agents or to bilateral companies to come and do business. So, of course, they are pro-corporate, so what else do you expect of them?
The civil war in Sierra Leone began in 1991 when the Revolutionary United Front, or RUF, tried to overthrow the government. They cited massive government corruption and the exploitation of their resources by foreign companies. It only ended when the UN and Great Britain stepped in to end it.
It was called Tony Blair's Good War, a supposed humanitarian intervention. Out of respect for their former colonial ruler, you can see British flags all over the capital, Freetown. There are even hundreds of children named after Tony Blair.
The RUF has now become a legitimate political party in the country. We met up with its leader in Freetown. He tells me that foreign exploitation of the country is still as prevalent now as it was before the war.
You can do anything. Britain can do anything to any poor nation. Americans can do anything to any nation. You have the might, you have the powers, you have the technology, you have everything. We are still beggars under your legs. We are not advanced as you are. Our governments are still going there begging for aid. Until and unless we can control our resources and stop begging, we'll continue to be puppets under your legs.
The UK government, however, says it's dedicated to the country's development, supplying a massive 60% of the country's budget through aid.
A lot of money is given to Sierra Leone in aid every year. Is this aid given with any strings attached?
Well, I would say yes. One string that is attached is that you have to make the investment climate as relaxing as possible for the investors. Right? Make it as relaxing as possible.
If these companies paid their tax, would you need aid?
We don't. I don't think we need aid. All the exemptions we are giving the companies, we are being paid. There is no need for us to go begging again.
I asked Eldred Collins whether the RUFP would ever use violence again.
As far as the RUFP is concerned, the word violence, the word armed struggle, is over.
The following evening, I was invited to speak on a local radio phone-in show. The topic, London mining and African minerals.
Yes, I remember. Ask not what Africa can do for you, but ask yourself, what can you do for Africa? Galaxy 106.1, Sierra Leone, Freetown, is giving it to you.
I'm Johnny Miller. I'm a British journalist. I'm over here with a camera crew to make a film about whether Sierra Leone is being exploited by foreign companies.
Bongo is the owner of the station. He tells me that they can't criticize the government too much or they'll face losing their license. He says he does try, though, to get the message out.
What I'm doing, I'm trying to see if we can help to educate our young people, because we see where we are. We are losing generation of people. 14-year-old not going to school, 6-year-olds not going to school. Now, how are we going to get these children back? We need to get these children by educate them, by giving them the history. And this will actually build slowly to bring back what we actually, the resources that we need.
For Bongo, the message for Sierra Leoneans is simple.
We keep going to the invader, we keep going to them with a begging bowl. We are begging them when we have got the riches into the country. So why can't we use our riches than to keep going to them and to actually asking them for money, when we can use that same money to actually better our country?
Ravaged by war, Sierra Leone remains one of the poorest countries in the world, with poor infrastructure and a debilitating unemployment rate. The solution is underneath the soil. However, it won't be there forever.
But what the Sierra Leone government would say, what the mining companies say, what many international business groups say, is that if you don't drop your tax rates, if you don't offer all these incentives, they'll take their business elsewhere.
Fine, fine. We are just one of many generations that are coming. Yeah? One out of the many generations that are coming. There are generations yet unborn that still need to partake of this natural resource wealth that we have at Sierra Leone. And so if we don't utilize it now, there are many more that will come after us that will have value, that will see value, and there will be people who will be prepared to pay more for what they have, we have on the ground, rather than us encouraging people to exploit it at our own detriment with nothing to show for it, and at the end of the day, we don't have anything to leave for our children, and then it will be detrimental for us as a nation in the future.
It's a kind of neo-colonialism situation we are into, and this is what is responsible for the perpetual hardship that is affecting most people.
Are they stealing from the Sierra Leonean people?
Yes, of course, that's exactly what is happening. It's a rip-off, a complete rip-off. And the British government, unfortunately, is supportive of that scenario.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Experts predicted a looming hunger cliff in the United States back in March, and they were right. According to new data, food insecurity in the United States reaches its highest number since December 2020. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout noted, back in March, as expanded pandemic era supplemental nutrition assistance program benefits expired, food insecurity experts were concerned that the United States was racing towards a looming hunger cliff. Now it seems that their predictions were correct, according to new data from the Census Bureau. As the Alliance to End Hunger wrote in a June 30 email, 26.5 million Americans reported food insecurity as of June 19th, according to the Census Bureau's Household Pulse Survey, the most thus far in 2023 and the highest number since December 2020. During the pandemic, SNAP benefits were essentially supercharged as Americans faced furloughs, unemployment, and widespread supply chain disruptions, which had already thrown the grocery buying experience into disarray. In a surge that was categorized as an unprecedented expansion by the New York Times, Jason D. Parrell, more than 6 million people enrolled for food stamps during the first 3 months of the pandemic. While SNAP benefits typically vary based on a recipient's income, during the temporary congressional expansion, recipients were offered the maximum aid available for their household size. However, those benefits were cut months early as part of a bipartisan compromise surrounding a program to provide grocery benefits to replace school meals for low-income children. At the time, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a nonpartisan research and policy institute, reported that the average SNAP recipient would receive at least $90 less per month. The Center reported some households who, under regular SNAP rules, receive low benefits because they have somewhat higher but still modest incomes will see reductions of $250 a month or more. The average person will receive about $90 a month less in SNAP benefits. In a March statement to Sloan Food, Eric Mitchell, the executive director of the Alliance to End Hunger, wrote that there is never a good time to make it harder for people to buy food. But ending benefits now comes at a particularly bad time. Mitchell said, with inflation and food prices still near record levels, it is still far too expensive for many Americans across the country to put food on the table. Without these extra dollars, millions of people will be at risk of hunger. He continued, writing that the expanded benefits were a lifesaver for many individuals and families as jobs disappeared and the economy grinded to a halt. In the ensuing months, the SNAP program has undergone some permanent changes, the most notable being that the age bracket for people who must meet work requirements in order to participate in the program was expanded. As Sloan Food reported in June, this was one of the several concessions made by Democrats as part of a deal to raise the debt ceiling, which the country needed to do later this year to avoid a default crisis. Prior to the pandemic, people younger than 50 who met certain requirements had to volunteer. work, or receive job training for 80 hours a month in order to receive regular assistance. Now, as part of the new budget cuts package, recipients are required to work until the age of 55. According to the Center for Public Integrity, the new stipulations also make it harder for states to waive those work rules in states. Yet after weeks of debate, the new budget cuts package now raises the age of recipients required to work to 55, and according to the Center for Public Integrity, makes it harder for states to waive work rules in areas with high unemployment. Notable exceptions include if someone is experiencing homelessness, is a military veteran, or if they are a youth aged 18 to 24 who has aged out of the foster care system. Currently, there are also two bills under review that would prevent current SNAP recipients from buying junk food classified as candy, ice cream, and prepared desserts, such as cakes, pies, cookies, or similar products, with their benefits. Several hunger experts have raised concern at both developments, especially in light of the newest food insecurity numbers. According to the Center on Budget Policies and Priorities, the expansion of working age would take food assistance away from large numbers of people, including many who have serious barriers to employment, as well as others who are working or should be exempt but are caught up in red tape. Meanwhile, a spokesperson from the Agriculture Department told Spectrum News that further monitoring of what SNAP recipients purchase with their benefits would increase program cost and complexity and undermine the dignity of millions of Americans by assuming that low-income Americans are unable to make decisions that are best for themselves and their families. According to NBC News, with food prices up 6.7% compared to this time last year, the United States service members and their families experience food insecurity at higher rates than the general public. Also, Guardian had reported, food insecurity remains stubbornly high in the United States. According to Guardian, 1 in 10 American households struggled to feed their families last year, with more than 5 million families missing meals and cutting portions due to poverty, new government research has revealed.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we try to answer your queries, your issues you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. And the answers are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified family. Well, today we have the pleasure to be with Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member at Al Mustafa University. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Yes, thank you very much.
Professor, you are helping us with the tips, with the points that how can we encourage our teens to be Islamic, and you have been helping us, like, we could encourage them towards Islamic art, we could encourage them to learn Arabic, we could encourage them for interfaith dialogue and community service. And now I want to ask you something. We have talked a lot about giving family time, having quality time with the family, but what we do in this time is also important. So how could parents actually encourage family time and involve their children in Islamic activities?
Yes, a very important point is that we should be able to engage with our children and give them, as you said, quality time. And what quality more than, for example, the recitation of the Quran together?
All right.
We should have an experience, a good, nice, exciting experience when we recite the Quran together. Unfortunately, we ourselves have not learned the Quran properly, and we can't teach our children to do so. So if we get involved in this, we need to first educate ourselves. Many of these child prodigies that we have today who have memorized the Quran by heart, and they can, you know, recite any verse from any page that you point out and say they memorize them. Many of them have been able to do so because their parents first took upon themselves to learn the Quran in the proper way and to memorize it. Then they were able to teach their children to do so. So we need to be able to learn ourselves the proper recitation of the Quran, its meanings, the melodious way of reciting the Quran with As-Sawt al-Hasan. And this is a beautiful experience that we should all be engaged in. And then in early mornings or in the evenings, we can get together, sit in a circle, and then everyone can recite. One should be the guide, the mentor, the coach, or we can invite someone to do so. But we sit all together in a circle, and everyone, the small boy of the five-year kid or the elderly person, they can all sit together.
Right.
I can cite you an example. In Qom, in the after Friday prayers, there's a sheikh who sits after the Friday prayers, and people sit around him, with him in a circle. There's a 4-5 year boy, there's a 60-year-old guy, there's a 40-year boy person. Everyone, they are sitting together in a circle.
Mm-hmm.
And he takes the lead, and everyone recites the way he does, and they everyone follows him. Then he wants them to recite individually. And then he points out the mistakes according to their level.
Right.
So that's a very beautiful learning experience. That can be repeated at home also. And we can get together to recite the Quran together. For example, we should be able to pray together. And the father should be the prayer leader. And he should be such that he is capable of leading the prayers.
Right.
He should have the qualities. It's not the mandate of a scholar only to lead the prayers. The family head can also lead the prayers.
Right.
And he should have the qualification to do that. The least qualification for every believing Muslim is that he is reciting the prayer properly, with proper, applying the proper rules, the pronunciation. Everything is so good that his family can offer their prayers behind him.
Right.
So this time is quality time together.
Right. These were some of the very beautiful examples. There's more to explore, so don't go anywhere. We'll be back in a while.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are talking about the family time and how Islamic things could be encouraged in this family time. Professor, you said that reciting Quran together in the family, offering Jamaat prayers together in the family could be very few examples of spending a very good quality time in the family.
Yes, we can sit together to learn the translation of the Quran or recite the Nahjul Balagha or Sahifa Sajjadiya or even the Mafatih al-Janan. We can recite the prayers together, everyone, every day, a small prayer with its meanings, with trying to understand, to discuss what the prayer is saying, what the holy verse is saying. There should be a discussion about it. The children should feel free to question. So we need to, you know, update our information and our knowledge also to be able to carry out those things.
I think I was discussing with one of my friends recently, which is the Quranic verse that has changed your life? And she would ask me the same question, which Quranic verses have changed your life? And then when we were explaining these things and explaining our experiences with these verses, her experiences were adding more to my knowledge regarding that particular verse, and my understanding of those verses added more to her knowledge about that particular verse. So sometimes if you discuss even questions like this in the family, it really adds to the knowledge, and you have a different perspective towards that verse, and different perspectives can actually help us lead to a very strong meaning.
Yes, so this interaction could lead to the emergence of something new for all of us. And if there's a question, then we can go out to a scholar and ask him. And also, for example, we could engage in reciting the book of practical laws, the Risalat, the Tawzi'ul Masail, and discuss the Masail, the practical laws of Islam together, and see how to implement them and to help each other to implement them. The proper way of ablution, the wudu, the salah, the tahara. So there's so many things can be done together in a collective manner in the family. So this is a way of, you know, educating our children without taking them to a class for it. Especially children, they run away from classes which are focused on Islamic, you know, things, Islamic teachings or whatever. So it can be done in a non-formal way. It can be done in an informal
way. Playway method.
Yes. So the important thing is they should learn the Quran. The message of the Quran, and they understand
content.
The Quran, and they also, you know, practice what is being said. So, or even we can discuss ethical issues, moral issues. We can also discuss the various issues that are taking place in the society, in our neighborhood, at the global level, at the regional level, even when we want to enhance our knowledge about the political currents and the affairs which are going on in the world and that they are impacting us as Muslims.
Exactly. Well, we have more in the store to explore on this topic, but after a short break, so stay tuned.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم said The best among you is he who learns the Quran and teaches it
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we're with Professor Salman Naqvi discussing what Islamic things could be encouraged in the family time. Professor said so far that we could recite Quran together, we could debate on the content of Quran, we could go for the congregation prayers together in the family, and do a lot of things. Well, Professor, you know, whenever there is this political discussion in the family, whenever we have some family time together, you would often see a father and a boy, they would get engaged in some political discussion. And seeing that, the mother and the daughter will prefer to go into the kitchen or do some kind of work which suits them more. But how important is it to for all of them to be together and to be discussing some ethical issue, which is actually emphasized in Islam.
Yes, when it comes to issues pertaining to ethics and morals and even beliefs, we can't discuss them in a vacuum, can we? All our beliefs, our belief system, our value system, they can be implemented and applied to different life situations, whether it is of a political nature, it is of an economic nature, it is of a social nature. So we don't necessarily, when we're talking about politics, we're not going to take sides with someone. We need to just analyze what's happening and seeing what is in accordance with our principles and what is not in accordance with our
exactly.
principles. We don't need to discuss personalities. We don't need to discuss maybe a person who is a political leader.
Like even if you're discussing politics, there's this beautiful book by Ayatollah Motahhari, Society and History, which discusses what an Islamic society should look like, what are the principles and basic elements of that society. You could actually discuss those issues, which could be both as per Ayatollah Khomeini as well, that religion is not different from politics. So even if we want to have some political discussions, we could actually see what are the issues that are happening in our society in line with our teachings of Islam, Quran, and the teachings of Ahlul Bayt.
Yes, so we need to bring out those principles and values in our discussions about the various issues that are being faced by society. For example, we have many political upheavals in this part of the world, in the West, in the Pak subcontinent, in the Far East. Everywhere we have issues which the Islamic Ummah is facing. Palestine, Kashmir, Yemen, so many issues. Indian Muslims, they are facing so many difficulties nowadays. So they have to be discussed, and the underlying principles and beliefs have to be mentioned to our children. They should realize and they should understand if there's some oppression taking place, there's some tyranny. So what are the principles which need to be understood, and what things are being done against those principles? For example, when you talk about the people in Kashmir, they don't have the right for self-determination, for example. That has been taken away from them. Apart from the Islamic teachings which we have, even the United Nations resolutions were there once upon a time when they had to be followed, but India did not follow them. So we need to understand those principles. We need to make our children understand what's happening in Palestine, what's happening
in Yemen.
Why shouldn't it remain as a country today?
So-called superpowers.
Not that we want to tell them to wipe it off the face of the earth. No, we want to tell them what is the basis for that.
Right. Thank you so much, Professor, for being with us and for that intellectual and that very strong discussion, which is really required, which is the need of time. Family time is there, but what should be discussed in the family time is also important. The professor gave us some of the very important tips. What should be discussed in that family time? Thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned for some more exciting episodes. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the Internet.
Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran says that it has filed